For some, the sea is not a place. It is a calling, a home away from home. If you find yourself drawn to the water, we can take you there. Imagine you, your friends, and family on a private yacht in the most beautiful places in the world, from the Bahamas or the Virgin Islands to Greece, Italy, Tahiti, and beyond. This is a yacht charter vacation with The Moorings, and it's easier than you think. Inquire today. Your next great vacation begins at moorings.com.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Here's a sample of a free podcast from the Post Wrestling Cafe. $6 gets you through the door at postwrestlingcafe.com.
On the earnings call, there was a lot of news coming out of it, and I guess the one that probably got the most headline treatment following the call was Netflix producing a bioseries on Vince McMahon that Bill Simmons will serve as executive producer on.
I hope it gets into a lot of difficult topics, because, I mean, you know, there's a lot out there that Vince McMahon has to answer for. Look no further than this entire season that we just saw of Dark Side of the Ring, where Vince McMahon is pretty much like the central character throughout the entire like series of multiple sins that the man, you know, has been at least attached to throughout wrestling's history. So I hope it's not just a very colorful, this guy grew up like this, and then he grew up like this, and then, you know, Montreal Screwjob, but he ultimately succeeded and beat WCW in the end, blah, 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 blah. I hope they get into a bit more of the weeds, you know, and offer a bit more of a, you know, kind of unauthorized, maybe, well, authorized, but also unbiased look at the man. But I also think, like, you have Netflix, you have Bill Simmons, you have this director of the Firefest, who I think have their own credibility to uphold.
Yep.
Very much so. So, I mean, there might be some contention, and I hope ultimately, like, Vince, you know, is the type of person who would be able to say, do what you want, you know, at least in this case. You know, I hope he's just, like, there to watch the final product and doesn't get too involved in what you can or can't talk about.
This cannot just be the Vince McMahon DVD they put out years ago that was comical. We should maybe rewatch that at some point as a primer for this documentary series before it comes out.
And welcome, everybody, to our first of six reviews of the Mr. McMahon series. That was Wei Ting and I in October of 2020, deep in the recesses of the pandemic, discussing the announcement the day prior that Netflix was developing a documentary series on Vince McMahon.
Why did our voices sound so much higher? Is it just me?
I'll blame some of it on maybe just audio deterioration over the last 4 years, and the fact that we were young and spry at the age of 36, I think, when that clip we were in our young, wild days of our mid-30s. Way.
We just hit puberty about 5 months ago. Yeah. Thank you. What a surprise, John. You always, no mention of playing these clips. You just kind of launched them, and thank you. I now have like a bit of a framework to sort of assess these episodes with.
I mean, I listened back to that, and it was like a 5-minute discussion we had, and I do say, when I go back and listen to these, like, you're pretty prophetic when it comes to like like, you kind of like, you could have said that 2 weeks ago, and it would have been in line with sort of all the questions we had going into this series. And the fact is, you were talking about other Vince scandals, because this preceded a year and a half the Wall Street Journal's first reports and such. But it's not like this guy had this pristine image pre 2022.
Oh, no. And I'm sure like the producers of this documentary were entering its production at that point in time with a similar mindset. But yeah, I mean, like many people, I think even up until earlier this month, John, like, we probably all had questions about the level of, I suppose, criticism that this documentary and this entire project would have had on Vince McMahon.
So tell me how you what you have watched up until this point. This is our first review. We're going to be doing daily releases of each episode of the Mr. McMahon series. This one is free for everybody, but episodes 2 through 6 will be reviewed at postwrestlingcafe.com, where your $6 gets you a month of access and all of our reviews of Mr. McMahon. But have you watched the entire series by this point or no?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have, John. So I've watched the episodes we're about to review here, or at least in this bulk taping session for you and I, John. I've watched them twice now. The latter half, I have to watch a second time. Yeah.
Okay. I blitzed through them all the day they came out, and then I did rewatch episode 1 and portions of episode 2, and I've kind of been going through it and such. So I kind of sitting down to do these shows with you, like I was doing like my own notes and research, and suddenly I'm realizing this is the rise of Vince McMahon, the national expansion, the first WrestleMania, the Ring Boy scandal, the steroid trial. There's a lot. And I think that kind of just gives you a sense of what they had to cover here in these first 3 hours that we're going to be discussing over kind of the first half of these reviews. But I guess, what were your just like initial thoughts when you sit down and one of the first things you hear is this?
I wish I could tell you the real stories. Holy shit.
Give us
no.
Why?
That's what I'm saying. I don't want to tell you these stories. I'll give you enough that it's semi-interesting. I don't want anybody to really know me.
Dramatic.
Yeah.
So this is going to be the half tell-all of Vince McMahon.
Mm-hmm. So I was prepared for that clip because I believe through the Men's Journal review that came out before the documentary's release, I was like the thesis of that particular review seemed to be that this is a series where Vince is very you know, he's not that willing of a participant to reveal that much about himself. So I kind of came into the series like almost expecting that. So it's not great. You know, you never want to start a documentary off by basically revealing that the subject that you're about to listen to for the next 6 hours isn't going to be completely honest and truthful. So I do wonder like why so much of, I think what we see here, I do think about from the perspective of the producers and why they decided to include certain clips and why they would have decided to put that particular clip on. And I suppose it's there to show you that, this is a guy who's very guarded about his own identity and, you know, what sort of insights can we gain from just that fact?
All of the lead up to this, a lot had been said about when this began, Vince McMahon pushed for this and he wanted a real documentary that he had told them, you know, I want this warts and all. This again, preceded all of the scandals and such. He did no interviews after June 2022. But when Bill Simmons and David Shoemaker were doing their sort of post-mortem on the process, one of the things brought up by David Shoemaker was, you know, he was gung-ho about this documentary process, but I don't know if he knew what it meant to be entering a documentary, like what this was for Vince McMahon, and if he truly understood what this was going to be, what this process was going to be, like just the idea of, I'm not comfortable speaking about myself, and I'll give you enough entertaining stories. Like what did he think this was going to be, that he was going to be giving a lot of his time to, and in theory being an open book?
Maybe we should just start off talking about that, you know, the timing of this project and why Vince McMahon himself would decide at this point in time to commission it, or at least 2020.
I think 2019 was when it was first like began the process, and October 2020 is the first public announcement of it. Nick Khan announces on an earnings call they're working with Bill Simmons, with Chris Smith, and WWE Studios, he notes, at that time. And it would be a massive budget that Netflix would be putting into this multi-part series, and and later, like, Nick Cotton would brag about seeing some of the early footage that's going to blow people away. Like, they were extremely like, this was going to be the definitive documentary series for WWE in terms of its most recognizable figure being profiled to this degree. And let's remember the timing too. This announcement comes just after The Last Dance comes out, so everyone has this idea of prestige documentary filmmaking in their rearview mirror. And if you're going to select the subject in WWE, Vince McMahon, if you can get an authentic or close to it version, it's compelling programming.
Do we know who proposed the idea first? Was it Vince going to Bill Simmons, or was it Bill Simmons suggesting it to Vince?
I don't know who was the first to contact who.
So nonetheless, why do you think Vince would agree to this project then?
Number one, I think that there was, I'm sure, like, Netflix was willing to spend a lot on this. And I don't know if Vince McMahon really was looking at this in terms of some kind of legacy defining piece or having his story out. I think he just saw it as a branding exercise. Like, I think that was probably what it came down to. But I don't know if he truly, and let's remember when this starts, like WWE is involved in this. Like, this is not like I'm just like giving up the reins of power here. You do as you would like. Like, they were going to have their involvement in this whole thing. And over time that would eliminate. So I think this is somebody that looks at the, like, I don't think he's looking at any kind of like journalistic exercise here on his life, nor would I think he even know how to carry that out. I think it is very much of the pro wrestling mindset that, like, you tell the most appealing version of oneself and present that to the public and leave the negative side. Like, that was the reason he hated Beyond the Mat. He felt it was too much of a downer.
Don't you think, though, he would have presumably at that point had The Last Dance as a reference point? And even within The Last Dance, I mean, it's not the most critical documentary about Michael Jordan, but, like, it does reveal many negative sides of the man. Don't you feel like Vince would have expected that? And from what we gather, like, his instructions to Bill Simmons was that he wanted the complete truth, or at least, you know, what he determined to be the truth.
And that comes with a lot of gray area. Like, when someone says, hey, I don't want a puff piece. Well, what's your definition of a puff piece versus what's our definition of a puff piece? And telling the whole truth, what's your version of the whole truth and what's my version of the whole truth? I'm certain that if on day one, is he aware that Bill Mushnick is going to be involved in this, that they're going to go into the Ring Boy scandal, that they're going to go into Rita Chatterton? You had to reasonably assume all of those things would be on the table, that we are going to go into this. But did he view this, that this would be closer to a in-house documentary on Vince McMahon versus an outside set of production companies that would be tackling the Vince McMahon story?
Sure. Yeah. As far as, like, why, you know, again, we can just only make assumptions about why Vince would agree to do it. I mean, I do think The Last Dance was, like, it was a very compelling series, one that I think we all maybe still hold to, like, a very high standard for, like, this sort of thing. And ultimately, I do think it, like, helped us celebrate, in a way, Michael Jordan and his career in totality again years later. And I don't think Jordan really came out of The Last Dance, like, with any sort of, like, negative, you know, repercussion for his image. And I could see maybe a Vince McMahon, you know, realizing, hey, I have this opportunity with Netflix, somebody like a Bill Simmons, who's a very reputable, you know, documentarian. And
they had previously worked, like, Bill Simmons had done the Andre the Giant documentary. So, I mean, they do have an existing relationship, mm-hmm. not to mention, right. like, Bill Simmons with Nick Cotton as well. Like, Bill Simmons is somebody that they have a history with.
Andre Doc might actually be a better reference point for maybe what his expectations might have been for something like this, you know, maybe taking this opportunity. Hey, I have all these things. My career is very likely, you know, sort of like at its tail end. And therefore, let's use the opportunity to just kind of cash in. And maybe if people want to celebrate my life, then hell, okay, this is it.
There's also the idea that, I mean, he brings it up in the documentary, the idea that when negative things occur, you put them in the past and you move forward. And I believe like that is his mentality, that as he's sitting down and he's talking about whether it's the steroid trial, whether it's Rita Chatterton, the Ring Boy scandal, all these things are in the recesses of his mind and he has moved on from them. It's like, I've beaten those issues. So then when a new controversy hits, boom, he's done doing interviews. Like, this is now in the periphery and it's not something that I have escaped or moved on from. It's something that is I'm facing instead of looking back on. And perhaps that is, you know, into the psyche of Vince McMahon, that he'll talk about things that are in the past because I have, in my mind, won against all those controversies. I have come out on top of all of those. I have not faced those repercussions and have no need to have to run from them. Yeah. Whereas, you know, as soon as that first Wall Street Journal story hits, like that's the end of Vince McMahon's participation in this documentary series and sends this thing into a spiral for multiple years. Because how do you, as Netflix, release this series without covering this and you don't have participation from so many of the key people you've spoken to, and the reliance is on your reporters that are the talking heads here? And one interview we see of Bruce Pritchard post 2022 in days before the Grant suit is dropped.
Yeah, and some of the Meltzer interview as well. Like,
the media interviews were the ones done after, right, that you have to kind of put everything together. Yeah. But
I think that's a major point in that we have to keep in mind when discussing this entire series is just the fact that it was changing so much, you know, during its own production and almost entirely as these scandals, or at least of these allegations, came out. And I do think it's evident in the product, in that in the final product, in that it kind of presents itself as one thing but then kind of gives you something else throughout. So let's just kind of keep that in mind as we discuss the rest of these episodes.
Episode one is really the origin story of Vince McMahon, and I wouldn't say that it's one where it dives heavily into his childhood and upbringing. Like, there are parts that are mentioned and abuse he underwent. I mean, his mother was married multiple times. Vince Sr. was, I believe, her second husband, and then marries an individual named Leo Lupton, who is the abusive father in question. And a reference point for many as they're going through these episodes is that famous interview he does in 2001 with Playboy. And in that interview, he alleges sexual abuse as well, and doesn't outright state who committed that, but says it was not the male. And the interviewer is kind of pushing, like, and, you know, he's not denying that it's his mother, and you're kind of left as the reader to assume that case, that this was someone that was the victim of both physical and sexual abuse as a child. He mentions the word incest in one of his sit-down interviews in episode one. And
we disappointed that we don't get more of that, like, in-depth discussion?
I think that is going to be a common criticism throughout the six episodes, is that there's a lot of heavy topics or heavy answers that are not explored more, that could be explored more. And you have to somewhat decide as the viewer what you want out of this series. Mm-hmm. There is the notion that Vince McMahon and his 40 plus years, you don't want to leave out any major events, and there are so many of them, versus the depth you're going to get into some of these. Like, if we were to go into super heavy depth into, say, half of these topics, and there's complete omission of others, would there be that criticism? I personally felt like there was just a lot of instances where stuff is not followed up on, and there's real, like, why did this happen? And instead of it being more what happened.
So I think in order to answer that, we have to ask again what the original intent of this documentary is. Is it to give us a chronological order of the history of the WWE? Or is it to tell us about what makes Vince McMahon tick? And that's where I feel like maybe the original intent of this versus like what this documentary kind of professes to answer at the beginning with, you know, by basically giving us that introduction, talking, teasing essentially the Janelle Grant story to come at the end. The question posed by the documentary at the beginning is, who is Vince McMahon? You know, is he's somebody who says he doesn't really know even who he is. It's Shane and Triple H suggesting that, you know, Vince is whoever he wants you to be. But the question that I think it's telling you that these six episodes will answer is, you will find out by the end of this whether or not this is Mr. McMahon or this is Vince McMahon, or, you know, whether or not that they're the same person. And to that end, I felt like it was something like him bringing up the idea of incest or any sort of like abuse in his own childhood is way more relevant to answering that question than, for instance, covering, I don't know, WrestleMania 2 or like, you know, Saturday Night's Main Event, you know, or whatever, even like some of the more well-known controversies like the Richard Belzer thing, you know, that has very little relevance to the makeup of Vince McMahon as a human being. And therefore, I do feel like it's something that they shouldn't have just glossed over like that.
I want to just read like a short excerpt from that Playboy interview that this is in Vince McMahon's words about the abuse. And the interviewer asks, "Your stepfather beat you?" And McMahon nods. "Leo Lupton. It's unfortunate that he died before I could kill him. I would have enjoyed that. Not that he didn't have some redeeming qualities. He was an athlete, great at any sport, which I admired. And I remember watching the Jackie Gleason show with him. We used to laugh together at Jackie Gleason." Playboy. "Lupton was an electrician. He hit you with his tools, didn't he? A pipe wrench? Sure. He hit your brother too? No. I was the only one of the kids who would speak up, and that's what provoked the attacks. You would think that after being on the receiving end of numerous attacks, I would wise up, but I couldn't. I refused to. I felt I should say something, even though I knew what the result would be." And they go on to ask, "Was the abuse all physical, or was there sexual abuse too?" McMahon, "That's not anything I would like to embellish, just because it was weird. Did it come from the same man?" "No, it wasn't. It wasn't from the male." And at the end, you can clearly see like Vince does not really want to go into it too much. And they ask, "You can leave that topic, but one thing first, you have said that the sexual abuse in your childhood wasn't from the male. It's well known that you're estranged from your mother. Have we found the reason?" McMahon pauses, nods. "Without saying that, I'd say that's pretty close."
Mm-hmm. So, and again, like, to be fair, like, it could be that the producers asked the questions and Vince just clearly, like, maybe didn't want to talk about it again, didn't give much. But even then, like, I feel like they would have at least shown if, you know, Vince's reluctance to talk about something like this. I mean, you hear something like that and you automatically just want a bit more detail, because I think it would probably tell you a whole lot about the rest of this person's life.
Yeah. And I mean, Vince McMahon has, you know, over time, like, he has kind of crafted his upbringing. And in Josie Reisman's book, Ringmaster, I would say if you want to learn the most in depth about the early years of Vince McMahon, I think that that's the biggest strength of the Ringmaster book. Like, Josie does like a really fantastic job of digging into his origins, what was true, what was not true about, like, you know, just the image he projected as this as a child growing up. But like, the general understanding here, without, you know, making this the whole Vince McMahon biography, is, you know, he does not know Vince Sr. until he is about 12 years of age, and then reconnects with his father. And I think that would have been really fascinating, just the more of the dynamics between the two. But we get enough here that, you know, not a theme I expected to see, but the thread of father and son is one throughout this entire series and spans multiple generations. We see Vince Jr. seeking the approval and love of Vince Sr. We see Shane McMahon seeking the love and approval of Vince Jr. And then we get a scene late in the series of Shane bonding with his three children coming out at WrestleMania that almost like breaks this chain of, you know, sons that cannot form that bond with their father. And I think that, like, that's one of the more understated themes of this entire McMahon legacy, is just like a fracturing of relationships between father and children, really, because we certainly see the Stephanie dynamics in this too, but I think it's more pronounced the Vince Shane Like it's pretty much out there for you to understand this relationship between their answers and just how they respond to questions about one another. And you get these kind of off the cuff, natural responses that certainly indicate a friction.
Yeah. Even to extend that, it's not just even within his own children, but his entire several roster of people that he employs that several look to him as a father figure. And you wonder what the basis of those relationships are, you know, not just from the perspective of the performers, but from Vince McMahon himself. And now that he's in this position to control so much, is he... In some way, does he enjoy being a father figure to so many other people? You know, he's certainly effective at doing it. So, these are all things that I wish maybe he could have spoken a little bit more about. And I wish the documentary maybe spoke a little bit more about. Now, I agree. I think the most interesting stuff in all of this is hearing him speak about his relationship with his dad and wanting his dad to say, "I'm proud of you," and how... at what, 2 days before his father's death?
The day before his dad's death, he's on his deathbed and literally, again, this is going back to the Playboy interview. And I think this kind of summarizes what we're discussing here. He explains how his dad was dying of cancer. "I went to the hospital and I kissed him. I've always been demonstrative. If I don't like you, I'll tell you. And if I love you, male or female, I'll hug you and say, I love you. But my dad was old Irish. The old Irish, for some reason, I don't understand. They don't show affection. That's not how I live my life. It's certainly not the way that my kids, Shane and Stephanie, were brought up. I don't know how many times a day I tell them I love them. But my dad, no, he never said it. Maybe he would say something complimentary about me to somebody else, but not to my face. That time in the hospital, I kissed him and said I loved him. He didn't like to be kissed, but I took advantage of him. Then I started to go. I hadn't quite gotten through the door when I heard him, 'I love you, Vinny.' He didn't just say it. He yelled it."
Wow. Okay. Interesting.
Which that would have been the recreated scene on Dark Side of the Ring of like this man on his deathbed getting up and screaming, "I love you."
Mm-hmm. Let's also, there's also the detail Vince revealed about how he never spoke to his father about why his father wasn't around to raise him. They never got into that conversation. And as far as we know, Vince doesn't necessarily know the answer to this day. So think about that. You know, think about growing up not knowing why your father wasn't around and never even choosing to broach the subject with him.
And being left in a horrific situation. Like, it's he's the victim of abuse. Listen, there's a lot you can get into. And I mean, we'll hear from Paul Heyman throughout our reviews.
I wish the documentary spent more time on this. Like, look at how much we're choosing to focus on versus, you know, the birth of WrestleMania 1, for instance. Like, this is the heart of the question that I think the documentary suggests that it's going to answer. What makes Vince McMahon tick? Who is Vince McMahon the person?
Isn't this the balance way of what we're kind of answering our own question for, of what Vince looked at versus what the public wanted? In that, for Vince, his legacy is his business. It is the creation of WrestleMania 1. That is the Vince McMahon story. And this is just like, this is sidebar stuff that is not.
It's a pseudo therapy session that, you know, we're trying to place on him. And I could see him not wanting that to be the project versus just the chronological retelling of his career.
Yeah. And it just, over time, when you're watching this with the perspective of everything that has come out and analyzing Vince McMahon as somebody that certainly strikes you from even later when he is very dismissive of concussion awareness, when you heard him in the whole like Janelle Grant issue with Dr. Carlin Kolker about seeking seeking therapy, and Vince McMahon just dismissing therapy. Like, this is somebody that has a lot of these outdated, very masculine views of science, of mental health, and somebody that clearly, I mean, grew up in what sounds like a horrific environment. And that does not excuse your own behavior, but it definitely informs you of this individual that this, in some ways, is a therapy session when you're being placed. Like, yeah, you're not with a you're not speaking to a therapist, but you're seated for hours speaking about yourself. Like, it's almost one in the same here, where I'm sure throughout these hours and hours of interviews, he's confronting a lot of his own hypocrisies, whether he's being forthright about them or not. He is at least addressing them in real time, and you catch him on camera addressing these as well and reflecting. And I do feel you get genuine moments where he is, especially when there's pushback or he is, his own words are thrown back at him and he has to be defensive. That's when you get like that crack in the foundation and you're not so much getting like a tailored response or my version of events. You're being contradicted or you're being challenged.
For some, the sea is not a place. It is a calling, a home away from home. If you find yourself drawn to the water, we can take you there. Imagine you, your friends, and family on a private yacht in the most beautiful places in the world. From the Bahamas or the Virgin Islands to Greece, Italy, Tahiti, and beyond. This is a yacht charter vacation with The Moorings, and it's easier than you think. Inquire today. Your next great vacation begins at moorings.com. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
So let's speak a little bit about maybe as you know, Vince presented, or at least the documentary presented, the chronology of Vince's career. This episode focuses on him taking over for his father. Were there any notable points of the way that they told that story that stuck out to you?
The way it works, like, he starts working for his father around 1969, and he's selling tickets, he's doing like ring announcing, and then he ends up going to promote in Bangor, Maine, as he mentions in this, and it's when Bill Cardilli, he's the ring announcer that exits in 1972 and gets he replaces Ray Morgan, who had replaced Bill Cardilli. And anyway, that's in 1972 that he comes on and is doing the play-by-play work. And he would host championship wrestling and is sort of just in the doing the syndication television. They don't go into some of his other promoted events, like the Evel Knievel Snake River Canyon jump that he does. He's involved in the Ali Inoki exhibition.
So apparently there's an Evel Knievel story that was left on the cutting room floor that Shoemaker.
I'm sure there was tons of stuff that was on the cutting room floor. Yeah, that being one of them. And I can't say like, oh, God, we didn't get the Evel Knievel story. But I mean, it goes to show you, like, there's a lot that precedes the national expansion of him, like running the Cape Cod Coliseum, like where he was running, not just like he was doing like hockey games and concerts. They had a minor league hockey team.
Oh,
like,
man, imagine if there's footage of that around. I'd love to hear that. Vince playing hockey.
Titan Sports gets incorporated in 1980, and then the sale of what is the Capital Wrestling Corporation to Titan Sports begins in June of 1982, and this is where he has the installments, where he has to pay his father. I think it's like four payments over the next year. Now, what's worth noting here is that, like, he's buying this thing for about $1 million for a company that is like, this is like a huge generating territory. Like, he's getting this for a bargain price, and it's like, you're going to buy these shares. And it is interesting, they focus on the fact that Gorilla Monsoon was positioned as the heir apparent, which I don't think was ever thought of as like the succession plan, or at least publicized to that fact of Gorilla Monsoon would inherit this territory. And it's Vince that completes the payments in June of 1983. And again, there's like references to the two clashing over the direction of the business. And like Tony Atlas stating, I don't think Vince ever liked his father. And Heyman stating, like, they would clash. But this is more so presented as, you know, that again, it's not really explored that deeply about what was that last year of Vince Sr.'s life, like, where he was essentially giving up the reins to his son, and something years later Vince would not do for his own son.
Right. A few things there I wanted to maybe touch on. Like, so the documentary doesn't really suggest that $1 million was a bargain. Is that like sort of widely accepted that like what Vince Sr. gave his son a discount versus maybe what he would have collected from Monsoon, for instance?
Well, what Vince was buying was like, I'm trying to like if your revenues are such, like, you're running the garden and you're in this very profitable northeast section of the country, it's like, okay, you're going to be spending this $1 million, but in turn, like, you know what you're going to be grossing. And it's could he have sold it for more? Yeah, I think he could have sold it for quite a lot more.
You had Linda. I thought, like, one of the most interesting parts of this was Linda saying we were essentially robbing
Peter to pay Paul.
To pay Paul, which I found very fascinating. The idea that because they were able to pay in installments, they were able to use the income that they were generating to pay for the company, which sounded like a sweetheart deal. I also found it really interesting hearing Vince speak about the idea of installment payments, especially considering recent events. He basically says, if you stop paying, then the deal is off, as, you know, like what he suggested to his father for.
And they all the shares revert back to the partners, which included Monsoon and Phil Zacco and Arnold Skoland, and he'd be out the money.
But the fact that he stopped paying and the deal was off is a big part of the reason why he's in the current heat that he's in right now.
Yeah. And like Vince and Linda, like, they do declare bankruptcy in 1976, right before the Muhammad Ali, Antonio Inoki fight / match. But just to get an idea here, like, this is from Josie Reisman's book, like, the gross income for WWF in 1984 was $29.5 million. That was the gross income for the company, which is, a year and a half after Vince McMahon assumes control and takes over. And like, it's a heavy, like, the national expansion, they certainly do exhaust their resources because they are going into a lot of territories. They're buying up television slots to get to replace the incumbents in a lot of these territories, where if there was an existing promoter, they would say, hey, we'll pay for your television time. You know, they were on WOR TV in New York, which was not cheap. There was a ton that they were spending in the lead up to WrestleMania, and they get several key things occur in the lead up to WrestleMania, from the idea that they were working with New Japan, but it was sort of just we'd trade talent, and then they end up charging New Japan and get a huge payment from New Japan for talent. There's also the sale of the time slots back to the WTBS slots that Crockett ends up buying, and they actually come out ahead after spending $750,000 for them on top of it. But it's positioned here as like the McMahons going all in for this first WrestleMania in 1985 that Vince McMahon came up with on a trip to the Caribbean and brainstormed it while in a Speedo. that I'm sure he was more than willing to give this photo for them to check out.
Maybe the last vacation Vince McMahon took, I guess, until his retirement.
Yes. What did you think about just the presentation of WrestleMania and kind of that stuff? Like, did you feel...
necessary, I suppose, when you're trying to discuss the history of the company and just the sort of celebrated mythology of Vince and Linda going all in for this thing, of which Dave Meltzer, as the sort of like gatekeeper of truth throughout this entire series, confirms, you know, like, yeah, like he probably would have lost everything if this show wasn't a success. Yeah, necessary, but like, you know, this is the point in the documentary where it feels like it's, you know, a pretty typical WWE like DVD style type of documentary release that just kind of tells you the chronology of what happened. And again, I recognize that this is a documentary made not for you and I. It's made for people that just kind of have some, you know, casual knowledge of the WWE, and to them this would have been new and this would have been a more relevant, interesting part of the story. For me, I think I was just more interested in getting past this so that we can learn a bit more about Vince himself.
Some other, like, there's a lot here. There's the transition from Bob Backlund to Hulk Hogan. The interesting note from Vince about, you know, Dusty Rhodes being someone they considered, but ultimately going with Hulk Hogan, which I think everyone would agree was the person to go with that.
I wonder if how Dusty would have been as, you know, the lead figure of the WWE.
I mean, at this time when Vince is going national, like, it's just at the tail end of Dusty in Florida before he's going to go to Crockett as Booker and top babyface. Right. You know, the idea, like, I think Dusty would have performed very well. He's just so far to me from the, it's interesting. Like, he has the, like, I think he has a lot of the elements that Vince McMahon would be attracted to. But I see the body as a big inhibitor for what Vince McMahon perceived as his top star.
Then why did Vince offer him the role? Or at least that's what's suggested.
I don't think... is that, like, clearly stated that he offered him the role? I think he was, like, someone that...
I think
he listed as a possibility.
Well, Vince said something to the effect of, like, Dusty couldn't take the opportunity or something to that extent. And Cody suggests that all he heard from his dad was that his dad didn't believe in the vision.
Yeah, like, I'm certain there was probably, hey, we want you involved here. Was it as concrete as you are the guy we are going to go with? I don't think it would have been as clear cut as that.
Things would have been very different with Dusty there. Like, I don't know if so yes, the body would be totally different, and if Dusty was successful, would that have totally changed our mindset of, like, what a pro wrestler should look like? What Vince's mindset of what a pro wrestler should look like?
I mean, it's totally different with Dusty in that role, and no Dusty in Crockett for those mid 80s years as well. Not just, like, on screen, but booking wise on top of it. Like, it's a very different industry. If
and what story would Cody be finishing if his father already won the championship?
The book would have been closed because he would have beaten the Sheik for the title, and that would have been the end of the story, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I also found the portions where they were talking about the Iron Sheik as sort of the transitional champion for Bob Backlund to Hulk Hogan pretty interesting. It's a section where they kind of get into, you know, wrestling's history with racism and xenophobia, and Bruce Pritchard essentially, like, being the one to tell us, like, wrestling is a reflection of, like, what society gives us, and using examples from Hollywood at the time that were kind of doing the same thing. You know, the line was, you were taught at an early age that foreigners were bad guys, which...
A classic clip of a fan being told he hates the Iron Sheik. Why is that? And the guy whispers to him, because he's from another country. Yeah, because he's from another country.
Yeah, which makes me really glad I didn't move to this country at that time, or like, even, you know, because I'm sure this exists in Canada as well, not just the US. Then you also had a line from McMahon talking about how we can't take the values of today and apply them to the past, which I agree is very true. You know, But I also think it's a very convenient way to absolve somebody of things that were actually distasteful even at the time that they were presented to. So, yeah, interesting.
And then after, like, they go through WrestleMania and, you know, this huge success. You know, the fact is, like, the week of, they, like, it was not considered, like, this is going to be this gigantic success. Like, they canceled, like, 70 closed circuit locations, which was the primary way to watch WrestleMania around the country. But that last week, there's a tremendous promotional push. They include Hogan and Mr. T, who they get on Saturday Night Live because the original host had to pull out. It was this actor-comedian named Steve Landsberg, and he was unable to host SNL, so Hogan and Mr. T got the last-minute spot to host SNL the night before WrestleMania. So that helped. This is where the Richard Belzer incident...
That's got to be a really busy, like, 48-hour period for, I mean, these two certainly, but really everybody involved with both shows.
And it turns out to be a very successful show, and I think there's more emphasis in this episode on Cyndi Lauper's contributions, but Mr. T should not be diminished either. He was a huge factor to that show being successful. But there's also like the MTV tie-in with the fact that they drew two tremendous numbers on MTV for mid-84 and then in February to set up the WrestleMania main event that does, you know, great numbers for MTV. And that's kind of how the first episode ends. It's where the tide is turning. Like, the territory system is still very strong in 1985, but as Meltzer outlines, it's like the war has been won. It's just a lot of these promoters don't realize it. But, you know, Crockett is still doing incredible business. Texas is, like, world class is, like, past the peak, but they're still in good shape in 85. AWA, they have not dissipated, even though, like, they've been gutted by the WWF, but they'd still get another 6 years out of things. You have, to a lesser degree, Memphis, Mid-South. Like, it's a very different world by the next couple of years where all of these promotions are falling by the wayside. And by the time we get to the 90s, like, it's just, like, essentially you have, like, AWA is on its deathbed. You know, WCW is not thriving in 90 or 91. Like, it's a much different universe of territories by the end of the decade. But the midpoint, there's still a lot of full-time offices that are doing well.
They are active, but not nearly as successful as the WWE.
In 1985, like, Jim Crockett Promotions is doing outstanding in 1985.
So we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves, but I guess maybe it's relevant to bring up now, but do you think that what Vince did to the territories was competition versus actively hurting them or whatever he thinks WCW was doing to him?
I think that it was the law of the jungle way that would come up later. I think that if you are, I don't think it's this line in the sand where it's like Vince's argument is, well, I was helping my company. I wasn't trying to hurt others. I was like, you don't really get to delineate those two because they're both like, by taking away these big stars from territories, like, you have your right to do that. Like, that is open system. Like, that's how it operates, but you're absolutely harming them. But you don't work for these companies. You don't owe, you're not building the industry. You're building your business. And that's kind of what Vince McMahon did here. There were, by the end of this decade, there's far less jobs in professional wrestling, full-time jobs, but you are also, you know, your revenue is going through the roof as well at the same rate. So, like, he grew his vision of wrestling and his business. But yeah, it was like, you compare the overall health of the U.S. industry from 1983 to 1993, and it's night and day.
And this was also a portion of the documentary that I kind of wanted to hear a little bit more about, you know, just the friction of trying to, you know, have your company expand into other territories and what that meant for the other people in charge of those territories. Like, we got Vince's perspective. We got maybe some of the workers' perspectives. But I would have loved to have heard some of the either surviving promoters or at least the children of the surviving promoters. Like, you know, like a Greg Gagne or like a Kevin Von Erich speaking about like what their fathers and their families might have been going through at the threat of Vince McMahon's expansion, I think would have added a little bit to those sections. But with any of these criticisms, I think we have to assess like whether or not these are topics that are maybe too deep into the iceberg for maybe a Netflix audience that this documentary was intended for. But I also ask, like, is this documentary as it exists interesting enough, you know, without getting into some of those things?
Final things here on this first episode. I'm going to run through some quotes, Wei. Let me know what some of the quotes that stood out to you, because these are ones that I noted. Paul Levesque, he's going to show you what he wants you to see. Bret Hart, I love Vince and have a lot of respect for him, but he was a guy that often lied to me and let me down with his lies. Shane McMahon, I think my dad gets the rap that he wants when asked if Vince gets a bad rap. Other ones.
So just even to stop you there, I think the Bret one is pretty interesting, like, because that's a modern quote, the fact that he says he loves Vince, but he's been let down. Now, it's not modern past the Janelle Grant allegations, which, you know, Bret has kind of spoken a bit more about denouncing Vince McMahon. But just having been through everything that he's been through with Vince, you know, the death of his brother and obviously Montreal and everything.
We'll get into it in later episodes.
To hear him say, I love Vince. Just even that line, I love Vince, even though it's followed with a but, still, like, the I love Vince, I think kind of tells you a whole lot about maybe the state of their relationship, at least at the time of recording that interview. Like,
that's a common theme of so many of these figures, is that it's not, this guy was not just a boss that they worked for. And even when they can clearly look back and say, man, I was played in this situation, or I was taken advantage of, or I was lied to. Like, there's so many that have such a reverence for Vince McMahon, whether it's Bret Hart and all of the baggage there, a Jim Ross, a Mick Foley, like all of these people, The Undertaker, John Cena, how many of them have this, you know, this fatherly tie to Vince McMahon that despite all of it, you know, it's like this reckoning for a lot of these guys to look back and look at this guy who has wrong them. And like, you watch this documentary, and for Vince, like, it's, you know, he talks about, I have this extended family, but it's at its core, like, he runs his business. Everything circles around that premise. Everything is business. And that doesn't matter if your last name is McMahon. It doesn't matter if you've worked for me for 14 years, like Bret Hart did. Everything is about the business. That will always trump any personal ties.
Yep. That's sort of the running theme of all of this, right? Is the only, like, God you get the sense Vince sort of prays to and bows to is that of business. And again, I think there's some sort of, like, I don't know, altruistic, I guess, feeling we're supposed to have when somebody says, hey, like, it's just business, I'm doing this for the health of the business, which I guess we're supposed to infer as, like, for the health of everybody that's attached to my business, I'm providing for their families, that's why I screwed Bret Hart, right? I also think it doesn't say enough about how much it serves him principally the most, you know? Like, it's his way of saying, I'm not being selfish. That's not why I screwed Bret Hart. I did it for the better of everybody else. But he's obviously the one who benefits the most from the health of his own business.
You also had Vince Jr. relaying the compliment he got from his father about the other promoters. You're beating them all. Fuck them all. Which I'm sure was a... I don't know if that was said on the deathbed or if that was in...
Oddly specific. I don't know
fuck
if
he'd
make that.
But the line that comes from Vince, only Vince who can introduce us to yet another word to add to his lexicon when discussing the state of women's wrestling during the MTV crossover, that women's wrestling was D-class-A in a D-class-A business. Wait, man. Did you feel that wrestling was D-class-A?
D-class-A. What does D-class-A mean?
Not classy? D-class-A.
Is it French?
Well, listen, I don't know if I've ever heard D-Class A used.
Must have been like a, I don't know, like a sort of trendy term when Vince was young to use.
Yeah, like things of that nature.
Yeah, D-Class
other A. Other Vince-isms, D-Class
Interesting.
A.
Interesting. I like it. Maybe I'll start using it.
Yes. All right. That is episode one. How did you feel this format went for us, Wei? I need to know for future.
It's good. I mean, I think the purpose of doing this like per episode is that allows us to kind of dive deeper into some of the nuances of every single episode. What we felt like, was it nuanced enough maybe in these episodes that we want to maybe fill the gaps with? So I thought it was cool. This one
I've got like eight windows open that I don't want to just be reciting like facts and stuff because my head is going to spin. I want this to be more just sort of a conversation about the episodes.
But give us what you feel like the documentary was missing. You know?
Yes. So there you go. That's episode one. We will now pivot to the post-wrestling cafe for the remainder of the episodes. At the back end, after episode six, we're going to dedicate time to your feedback and questions. If you have specific questions about anything that was covered in the doc, not covered in the doc, we'll do our best to answer those at the end. But we'll dedicate time after we have reviewed all six episodes, which we will set up a thread in the forum for. But yes, we are back on Saturday, postwrestlingcafe.com, and that is where we will be releasing daily editions of The Double Shot through next week, covering episodes 2 through 6. So we hope you enjoyed this free preview, I guess, or review of episode 1, and we will see you all on the Post Wrestling Cafe.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.